let's get rolling again. You can see, you know, intervening with borderline personality disorder takes some patience and persistence, but it also works. Now, there's no shortage of additional complexities to deal with. One thing that comes up a lot is suicidality and self-mutilation. Now, in suicidality, we talked about that back with depression, and the usual approach to dealing with suicidality works just as well with borderline clients as with anybody else. But how the heck are we going to deal with self-mutilation? Well, you know, back in the late 80s, Leibniz and Lowndes, Cowdery wrote a really interesting article in the Journal of Personality Disorders where they got five different borderline self-mutilators to write first-person accounts of an episode of self-mutilation. And then they got big-time experts to respond with their perspective on it. And on page 12 in the handouts, we've got a very brief summary in here. What's going on? Why do people cut themselves, burn themselves, insert stuff, etc.? Well, here we got a bunch of different examples. You know, we got a woman who feels rejected by her doc, feels an urgency about having her needs met. She feels building rage because her needs aren't being met. She tries to tone down her rage by being more active. It doesn't work. She's starting to have anxiety symptoms. She's starting to have dissociative symptoms. She cuts her arm with a razor. She doesn't feel much pain, but it gives her relief from all her symptoms. And then she feels ashamed afterwards. And sounds like that's giving her relief from intolerable affect. We got another person who feels rejected by her therapist. She starts feeling desperate. She blames herself. She feels hopeless. She wants to escape the pain. She tries reckless driving. It doesn't work. She hits herself with a hammer. It doesn't work. She takes 6 Xerox. It doesn't work. She calls the group co-therapist and talks to him about feeling rejected without telling him about hurting herself, and he reassures her, and then she falls asleep, probably because of the 6 Xerox. You know, we've got a woman who's having fantasies of self-mutilation, and she's frustrated at work, and her tension and frustration, self-hate build, and she has more fantasies about self-mutilation. She calls her therapist, but he's not available. She cuts herself with a razor. She feels some pain, but it gives her relief from the emotional pain, and then she's worried about how people are going to react. We got a client who's mad at his psychiatrist. He wants to get even. How could I get even with my psychiatrist? Aha, I'll burn myself. This seems like a good idea. He burns himself with a cigarette, and then, but he's concerned it might not leave a scar, so he goes into his next appointment and says, "See what you made me do." You know, we've got a woman who feels like nobody realizes the pain she's in. My pain has to be seen to be real. She carves words in her arm with her razor, and then she feels ashamed afterwards. My take on it is, it sounds like different things are going on at different times. Sometimes cutting gives the person relief from intolerable affect. Sometimes it's an attempt to have an impact on others, etc. So it sounds like we don't have one dynamic going on each and every time. So sounds like for intervention, first of all, we're going to want to figure out what the heck is going on this occasion. How do we do that? We turn to the next page in the handouts. And, you know, taking specific episodes one at a time is quicker and easier than talking in general terms. So rather than asking, why the heck do you cut yourself, you know, let's take a good concrete example, a time you remember reasonably clearly. What was the situation? What led up to it? What were you feeling? What thoughts were running through your head? What did you do? How did you feel then? And that's going to make it a lot quicker and easier to understand what's going on. And I'm going to have some preconceptions going into this. It's real handy to set those aside and pay attention to what's actually going on. You know, part one psychodynamic view is self-mutilation is anger turned inwards. Maybe. Maybe not. I'm going to want to check and find out. And if this person is turning anger in on themselves, I'm going to handle it differently than if they're trying to escape intolerable symptoms or if they're, you know, it's a way of handling their anger at their psychiatrist. Once we understand what the motivation is, then we can go to our intervention plan with suicide. You know, is this a good way of accomplishing what you're trying to accomplish? What's the downside to it? What other options are there? Are there better ways? You know, if I want to get my people that take my pain seriously. You know, carving words in my arm is one option. Are there other ways to get my pain taken seriously? If I want to get relief from feelings of dissociation, cutting myself is one option. Are there other ways to get relief from dissociation, etc.? You know, if I want to get even with my psychiatrist, burning myself is one option, or I could let the air out of his tires, or I could report him to the licensing board, or I could give him a piece of my mind. And the general model of understanding what the person is trying to accomplish, highlighting the drawbacks of the dysfunctional way of accomplishing it, and identifying more promising ways of accomplishing what they want to accomplish, works damn well with self-mutilation, just like it does with suicide. Now, sometimes it takes a little thought to figure out how the heck can one accomplish this. What are, do I know anything about dealing with dissociation? If not, I may need to read up on it. Now, with borderline clients, you run into some impediments that don't come from the average person. With a lot of borderline clients, we'll talk it through up to this point, and their drawbacks to their current way of handling their anger, their psychiatrist, there are more promising options. And there are a lot of borderline clients will say, well, it sounds good to me, doc, I'd love to, but the impulses are just so strong I can't resist them. It sounds to me like this person could stand to get better at impulse control. How do we do that? Well, we look at the bottom half of page 13. If you think about the case about which you have an impulse and then control it reasonably well, what else involved in doing that? Well, gee, I need to notice the impulse before I act on it. I need to make a good choice about whether to act on it or not. If I'm not acting on it, I need to figure out what to do instead. And I need to implement these alternatives and then see how they work out in real life and learn from the results. Pretty simple and straightforward. Borderline clients can run into problems at many points in the process. Problem number one for a lot of borderline clients is, gee, sounds like it would be useful to get better at controlling impulses. For a lot of borderline clients, their response is, why the hell should I? Because they've had years of parents and teachers and employers and parole officers trying to make them control their impulses. And they're primed to perceive me as doing the same thing. How do I want to deal with it? I like to take the question seriously. Good question. Why the hell should you control your impulses? When you have been an impulse, and I'll take a concrete example from, when you're fed up with your boss and, have the impulse to punch him out, when you do that, how happy are you with the results? Oh, that got me fired and him pressing charges against me. So it sounds like if you want to get fired and have charges pressed against you, punching out your boss works great. If you don't want to get fired and you don't want to have time in the county jail, then it might be useful if you could hold off for a second and come up with a better alternative. And one of the things I'm trying to highlight here is I'm not making them control their impulses. I'm trying to help them do something they want to do. I'm not taking their impulses away from them. They're always going to have the option of punching out their boss. We've all got the option of punching out our bosses if we want to. It's generally not going to turn out to be a good move. It's generally going to turn out that there's a better alternative. But we're not taking away that option, and we're not making them do anything. We're trying to help them have a wider range of options and choose the ones that work out the way they want. That makes sense to them. That maintains the collaboration. That gets them on board with the process. Now, another impediment for a lot of borderline clients, they feel like the impulse just hits them full force, which makes it challenging to deal with. That doesn't fit with my experience of how impulses work. Seems to me, being impulses generally start off milder and build up. It can happen pretty quickly if this is something I've been through repeatedly. One possibility is we've got somebody where their just impulses hit more suddenly and more strongly. Another possibility is the person is not noticing mild and moderate levels of the impulse. If it seems to me my emotions are not okay and my impulses are not okay, how do I deal with that? Well, people deal with it in a variety of ways. One of the ways people deal with it is just trying to ignore them, pretend they're not there, which then makes it challenging to notice them when they're mild and easier to deal with. So it might be useful to talk over, You know, is there any chance that they're not in the habit of noticing and processing mild and moderate impulses, mild and moderate emotions? Would it be useful if I could notice the impulse before it reaches full force? Oh, yeah, that would be awful handy. You know, maybe it would be useful to practice. You know, if I'm getting angry, how would I notice? What would be early signs of anger? Oh, if I'm clutching my fists and pounding on the table. Actually, Carla, with the woman who had a loaded handgun, is a great example. You know, we went through a long time of her having a really hard time acknowledging any emotions. We slowly made some headway on that. And then in one session, she would go, "I do not feel angry." Okay, I can point this. Gee, you are pounding the table. You are raising your voice. This gives the appearance of being angry, but you find yourself saying that you're not angry. What's going on here? Help me understand this. Turns out she grew up in a family where both parents were abusive. And she witnessed some pretty intense interactions between her father and her older brothers as they went through adolescence. As she approached adolescence, you know, she stayed out past curfew. One night her dad started reading her the Riot Act. She yelled back, and his response was, "I'm going to teach you to control your anger or kill you trying," with a lot more intensity than I'm doing at the moment. And she took him at her word. And, you know, she picked up the idea that if I express anger, I'll be destroyed, was how she worded it. And then later on, she picked up the idea that if I express anger, it'll destroy the other person. Is it any surprise that she's not willing to acknowledge anger, which makes it really tough to deal with anger adaptively? So we needed to work through the value that, hey, if I notice mild and moderate anger, hey, this doesn't destroy anybody, this doesn't get me destroyed, this is useful. This opens up a range of options. And, you know, if I'm mad at somebody, I've got the option of blasting them, but I'm not required to, and I've got other options. And, you know, and in brainstorming a range of alternatives, you know, certainly being assertive, picking it up with the person I'm mad at is an option worth considering. But also, you know, what sort of options do I want to have on the list? A lot of people find that vigorous exercise gets it out of the system. That's one worth trying. I could vent to an uninvolved third party. I could meditate. You know, I could handle it indirectly. I could handle it directly. I could quit the damn job. And in coming up with alternatives, it works best to generate a bunch of alternatives, good, bad, and mediocre, and then sort out the good ones. If I try to just come up with good alternatives, the client's likely to feel like they're being railroaded and resist that. So with the person who wants to get even with their psychiatrist, you know, we'll put on the list. I could let the air out of their tires. I could file a complaint with the licensing board. I could make prank phone calls in the middle of the night, as well as more promising ones, like I could sit down and talk it over with the dude. I could change psychiatrists, you know, et cetera. And then we'll look at the pros and cons of each of the alternatives and pick more promising ones. I haven't had anybody yet where letting the air out of his tires turns out to be the most promising alternative. And then, you know, plan how would one put this into practice in real life? Do I need to practice some to get this, develop the skills? Should we role play this some? Do I want to try it first in low-risk situations and build up to the high-risk situations? And it turns out that, you know, you can improve people's impulse control pretty dramatically within just a few sessions. Real handy line of intervention. Now, at the same time, it's handy to address the intensity of the emotions. You know, and if we haven't already addressed dichotomous thinking, that's really useful to get to. It's also real useful to help the person think through. A lot of borderline clients presume that intense reactions are going to get better results than moderate reactions. And it's not illogical. You know, you would figure that trying harder is going to get bigger results. It's really handy to help people to think, get through, and register, you know, does getting really upset get better results? You know, if my reactions seem out of proportion with the situation, it may well get people thinking I'm a crackpot rather than getting me taken seriously. And, you know, the person actually may have had very little practice at expressing themselves mildly and see what the results are, expressing themselves moderately and seeing what the results are. That's something that we can talk about and then try as behavioral experiments out in real life. We could also notice in our interactions within the session, do they need to yell at me to get taken seriously? Or does expressing themselves mildly or moderately work just fine? Does actually yelling at me result in us wasting time dealing with their, you know, my reactions and their reactions and all that convoluted stuff? Does it actually work better to express themselves moderately? And one of the things that's often an important part of the package is helping them to sort out is, you know, putting a lid on my feelings as much as possible, a good, bad, or mediocre move. An analogy I use with a lot of clients that work reasonably well, you know, let's imagine we've got a river that floods from time to time and wipes out all the towns and villages downstream. This is not a good thing. What do we do? We call in the Army Corps of Engineers. You know, what are they going to want to do? They're going to want to build a dam. They love building dams. Are they going to try to build a big, strong dam that'll shut the river off? No, not only would the ecologists give them hell for doing that, but that's not going to turn out to be a good idea because the water is going to keep piling up behind the dam. Sooner or later, no matter how big and strong the dam is, sooner or later there'll be more water behind the dam than it can handle. We have a flood, the dam washes out, and this wipes out more towns and villages downstream. Building a dam is a fine idea, but we'll build a dam with a spillway and choose when to let water through and how much water to let through. Trying to time it so there's always reserve capacity behind the dam, so if a thunderstorm comes through, we're not overwhelming the dam. It's not that putting a lid on my feelings is automatically a bad idea. It's trying to put a lid on all my feelings all the time turns out to be a bad idea, because that results in getting to the point where I find myself going nuclear over something small. And then I look at the carnage in terms of people's reactions, the impact I've had on them, and so on. And, oh my God, my anger's terrible. I have to control my anger, by which I mean put more of a lid on it. It's hard to have enough perspective when you're in the middle of it to recognize being angry isn't the problem. The problem is suppressing my anger as long as possible and then going nuclear over something small is a problem. And it might be a good move if I could spot the anger before I'm at the exploding point and choose. You know, do I want to speak up to the person who's getting on my nerves? Do I want to go work out? Do I want to complain to my neighbor or my priest or my bartender or my therapist? Do I want to meditate? Do I want to look at it from the other person's point of view? There's all sorts of options I've got for dealing with anger. And if I notice the anger when it's mild or moderate, I've got the option of taking a little time to think it through and try to make good choices how to deal with it. If I pretend it's not there as long as possible and go nuclear over something small, this doesn't work out nearly as well. How's all that sound? And, you know, some of what we end up working on is very simple stuff that you would presume is obvious. You know, if you turn to page 15, this is taken from one of Lenihan's handouts from her skills training group. And, you know, if you look at it, this is very basic stuff. The idea that it's useful to pay attention to the relationship and not let stuff build up and address problems before everything hits the fan. And, you know, find the balance and consider my own needs and the other person's needs. And a lot of clients react as though these are brilliant insights. That just because something's, you know, capable and high functioning and so on, doesn't mean it's safe to presume that they've got their act totally together. That particularly in problem areas, there may be some fairly basic stuff that they have not worked through, usually for very understandable reasons. One therapist reaction that comes up a lot, I intended to touch on this earlier, is it's easy to get out, why does this person keep doing screwy stuff? And another good point Lenihan makes is it's a pretty good bet that at each point the client is doing the best they can, using the best options they see. They're not thinking, how can I screw up my life? I know, I'll go do something dumb. They're thinking, oh my God, I'm being abandoned. How do I make it stop? And they don't have the perspective to register, wait a minute, maybe it would be a good idea to check out whether I'm actually being abandoned or not. And maybe it would be a good idea to react one step at a time rather than going nuclear. And so if we can help the person find more promising ways to deal with the different issues they're dealing with, this ends up being really useful. I've mentioned dialectical behavior therapy a number of times. It's an interesting and useful approach that has a good deal of research behind it. You know, Linehan came out of her research into suicidality and ended up working with borderline personality disorder. And she and her grad students were sitting around her living room one day trying to figure out how to make sense of the extremes with borderline personality disorder. And one of the grad students' husbands wandered through the room and said, oh, you guys are talking about a dialectic. And they said, what the heck is a dialectic? Turned out he was a Marxist, dialectical materialism. He explained dialectics to them. They found this a useful concept. And, it got cognitive behavioral roots, but it's a hybrid of cognitive behavior therapy and dialectical materialism. And I find the conceptual framework gets a little complex for my taste. Now, not everybody's brain works the same way. It may be very natural and common sense for them. What the issue they found with the population they were working with is the clients didn't have a lot of the skills in assertion, impulse control, etc., that they needed to handle situations adaptively. Oh, it sounds like we should work on skill training. But when they worked on skill training, all these deep, dark, emotional, fear of abandonment, trauma history, and so on, flared up and mucked up working on the skills. And if we try working on the skills, the emotional issues muck things up. If we try working on the emotional issues, the person doesn't have the skills to deal with these situations. Hey, let's do a skills training group to work on the skills, and individual therapy to work on the big, dark, complex emotional stuff, and that'll make things a lot more manageable. The individual therapist just deals with the complexities, the skills training group just deals with the skills. And then they found the therapist kept wandering off protocol, so okay, we need a consultation group for the therapist too. And the dialectical behavior therapy is a good intervention approach that works well. It does take a lot of resources. If we're going to concurrently do a skills training group and individual therapy and a consultation group for therapists, a solo practitioner cannot do that unless you're going to do a one-person consultation group. This does not make sense. And also, in solo practice, it's real tough to keep groups going because you just don't have enough people who are willing to meet at the same time of the week. If you're in a hospital or agency setting or a large group practice, it may well be viable to do group therapy and individual therapy and a consultation group. But this uses a lot of resources. Marsha's take on it is we need to do it this way because trying to do skills training and in individual therapy just don't work. Now, wait a minute, I've been talking about working on impulse control and dichotomous thinking and so on in individual therapy. And it works for me. Why is that? Well, A, I'm working with a milder population than Marcia was. She developed her approach initially with chronically suicidal borderline women who are being hospitalized several times a year, unable to hold down a job, etc. And I can buy the idea that at the extreme end of the continuum, trying to do once a week individual therapy is going to be real challenging. One completely legit way to do it is to divide things up the way they do in DBT. Or I could see the person more than once a week, or we could have developed an intensive outpatient program, or there's a variety of different ways to set things up. But for people in the extreme end, the once-a-week model is not going to be sufficient. And actually, for most of my case examples, there were stretches where I was seeing them two or three times a week, and then we tapered down to once a week once the dust settled. And I think there might be one or two of them that I saw once a week all the way through. You know, we need to be aware of what the person's needs are and find practical ways to meet the person's needs. And if I can't do it in an outpatient setting, then we might need to consider an intensive outpatient program, an inpatient program, etc. Inpatient programs may or may not be a good idea depending on how sophisticated they are at dealing with borderline personality disorder. There's a number of studies showing that on the average, when borderlines go into inpatient programs, they get worse and they cause lots of problems in the program. So it's a much better idea if you've got a program that's got some sophistication in dealing with borderline personality disorder. Likewise, if you have one or two borderline clients in an unstructured group, that often gets real screwy real fast. Having a group of borderline people is a much more challenging concept, but it often works much better. And for a long time, dialectical behavior therapy was the one treatment approach that actually had outcome data showing that it worked. Now, the good news is we've actually now have a number of cognitive behavioral approaches that work. Arndt and company in the Netherlands have been doing a version of schema-focused therapy with borderline personality disorder that's getting some good results. And in terms of the approach I've been describing, the Moore-Becking approach, at the bottom of page 15, we've got an open clinical trial where they actually got good results. And one thing that's real interesting is improvement continued after termination of treatment. At the 6 months follow-up, only 16% met full criteria for borderline personality disorder, and 55% showed two or fewer symptoms of borderline personality disorder. You know, does this show that CBT cures borderline personality disorder? Well, it depends on what you count by as a cure. If you mean no longer meeting full criteria, then that sounds like what it's showing. Does it mean the person's fine and has no problems? No, that's not. You know, if you still meet two criteria, you've still got some problems. But also, this was 1 year treatment. You know, 50 weeks of weekly CBT. And I figure on the average, if I'm starting from scratch with your average borderline client, I'm figuring 1.5 to 2.5 years of therapy. Two or three times a week during periods of crisis, weekly when things are going fine. This is not quite short-term in the 10 or 20 session framework. On the other hand, Masterson figures 5 to 7 years of multiple sessions per week, so I don't think we're doing too shabby. It is a challenging problem to work with, but it also can be real rewarding. In terms of outcomes, you know, Carla, the lady with the loaded handgun, you know, not only did we have her not dying, but over the course of treatment, her husband had a respiratory arrest, was in a coma for months, and ended up dying, and we got her through that alive. And we resolved a lot of her overreactions and drama, and got to the point where not only was she in a decent mood and doing okay from week to week, but she was actually in a promising relationship with a reasonable guy, and she dealt with the anxieties and insecurities of a new relationship and seemed to be doing pretty decent. And then she terminated therapy on her own while we were working on her fear of intimacy, and I don't have any follow-up beyond that. Jane was seen 73 times over a period of 11 months, mostly twice a week with some scheduled phone texts and contact in between when things were really rough. And her psychiatrist tried a variety of different medications and came up with a regimen that worked okay. We got through a variety of suicidal crises and got to the point where rather than being hospitalized once or twice a month, we got to where it had been 2 months since she'd been in the hospital, and the police were no longer being called to their apartment, and their relationship was improving. And then she got mad at something, me about something, and fired me. So you don't always get people to persist in treatment as long as you'd like. Joan on the videotape I saw weekly for a total of 5 months. She got in here on the job hunting and got a perfectly reasonable job and was doing okay and was coping with dress code and schedule and so on. It was dealing with work in office conflicts without tantrums and was more comfortable with her marriage and doing fine. She was still on the high-strung side, still had tended to demand too much of herself, and had not yet made a whole lot of new friends in the new city. But she felt ready to work on those on her own. We terminated by mutual agreement, and she didn't call back for more help. And I'm pretty sure that's because she was doing okay. You can accomplish a lot. My first client and my first practicum turned out to be borderline. It was a real learning experience. And she was also a grad student in a mental health-related field. She finished her thesis before I finished mine, and it ended up doing quite well, even though it was a very challenging experience. Questions, comments, reactions?
One of the things that you didn't talk much about when you're working with a borderline personality individual, the environment at home.
Mm-hmm.
I worked with adolescent who had divorced parent, two parents, two households she's living with, and both parents are after us, kind of scoring what are the points so they can kick her out of the house.
Mm-hmm.
That was the so anything happened they overreacted. It just went crazy to the point. That
And there are two important elements there. One is, if we're talking about kids and adolescents, just doing individual therapy in isolation and ignoring the family context is not a good move.
Mm-hmm.
The family plays a really important role in the lives of kids and adolescents. If it played a role in the development of the problem and the environment does not change, I'm going to have to be awful damn brilliant in my time with the client to outweigh the impact it's having the rest of the time. If the family had nothing whatsoever to do with the development of the problem, but they're not on board with doing what's helpful, then we're missing out on all the benefits we could get from involving them. And so with kids and adolescents, I don't want to presume the thing to do is individual therapy just because the pediatrician referred the kid to me. I want to do an evaluation that includes the parents, at least preferably the whole family, and I want to make a choice. Do I do individual therapy, family therapy, conjoint therapy with the parents, some combination of the above? And occasionally, individual therapy with the kid and a little consultation with the parents is a good move. But usually, particularly when you get to more severe problems, involving the family a heck of a lot more than that is usually a good move. And if, in general, if I had to choose between individual therapy with the kid and family therapy, I'd go for family therapy every time. The family has a really major role in the lives of kids, and overlooking that, is not a great move. With adults, you get a lot more times when just doing individual therapy with the adult works just fine, but the more relationship issues there are, the more it's important to pay attention and make a choice. Do we need some marital therapy as well? Do we need some individual therapy as well? Do we need to do marital or family therapy and forget about the individual therapy for the time being? That, if I'm just working with the individual and whatever screwy dynamics there are in the family are going along unchanged, this works against me and greatly decreases the odds of my being effective. And with adults, it varies from case to case, whether we need active involvement of the spouse and or family or not. Sometimes you can handle things just fine in individual therapy by helping the client find more effective and adaptive ways to deal with their spouse, their parents, etc. And sometimes that's not enough and you need to get some marital or family therapy going as part of the package. Yeah.
So can it be, I'm working with a teen and her mom, and I try to get them together, but it's so hard.
Mm-hmm.
So I end up working just with the teen and then discussing with the mom afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So the teen, when she talks, like, she every session is a problem. Mm-hmm. It's hard to keep her on track.
Mm-hmm.
And she keeps complaining that her mom does not, that the mom is showing her conditional love.
Mm-hmm.
That the mom does not love her unconditionally.
Mm-hmm.
And that she needs her own space. She wants to do, she's, every time she comes up with a challenge, as mm-hmm. you said, you know, regularly trying to test you,
mm-hmm.
that's what she does with her mom. Like, mm-hmm. today, I'm not going to do this anymore at school because that's me.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2 weeks later, she comes up with something else.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, for the mom, it's a constant
mm-hmm.
stress.
Yeah.
That the mom does not want to deal with in person, like in individual therapy or, you mm-hmm. know.
Well, so, you know, we got many issues packed together here. You know, adolescents don't have the same skills in problem solving and impulse control and so on that we presume with adults. We may need to spend more time working on that. You know, if it's hard, if the ideal would be to see them jointly, but this is hard to work out, paying attention to what's hard about working this out. If it's a practical scheduling problem, you know, can I make some changes in my schedule? Can I get them connected with somebody who has a different schedule? If it's mom doesn't want to deal with this, which sounds like it's a big part of why it's hard to get the two of them together, you know, I can be empathic with mom about how frustrated and aggravated she is and how she doesn't want to deal with it. And then segue into, and so one option is to not deal with it. How does that work out for you? How long have you been trying to not to deal with it? How happy are you with the results? One option is to continue to handle things the way you're handling things currently and continue getting the same results. And it's you got the right to do that if you want to. But what are you could try doing things differently in the hopes of getting different results?
What would be the focus if you deal with family in case of BPD?
Well, first of all, you know, if we're going to work collaboratively, we need to negotiate goals for therapy. And in working with a family or a dyad, we need to negotiate mutual goals for therapy. You know, and mom's going to come in with her set of goals. Kid's going to have her set of goals. I can have my own ideas about what would be useful to accomplish. So we're going to need to spend some time negotiating goals that everybody can get on board with. And it sounds like, you know, more effective communication and problem solving and impulse control and so on would be all useful part of the package. But, you know, it's not one standard set of goals that's going to apply to everybody. Now, it also sounds like it would be useful either individually or in the joint sessions to help the kid think through what's she trying to accomplish. If what she wants is unconditional love from mom, and the way she goes about it is to set out these different challenges, how well does that work as a way of getting unconditional love? Gee, she's been doing it for a while. It sounds like that's made things worse rather than better. You know, suppose somebody wanted unconditional love from her. What would be smart for them to do? They could challenge her every few weeks in the hopes that that will result in unconditional love. What does she think? Would that result in her feeling fondly towards them? Or would there be more clever things that they could do? And helping her think through, is what I'm doing a promising way to accomplish what I'm trying to accomplish? With an adolescent, we're probably going to need to do more of the work on helping them break it down into manageable chunks and think ahead about what the likely consequences are. Because this is a skill, once you get into formal operational thinking, you're sort of theoretically capable of doing that. But a lot of people haven't yet polished up the skills at it, and an adolescent's probably going to need a lot more help with that. You know, an adult who's made, if we've got an adult who's made it through college and holding down a job and so on, then that sort of implies they're not too bad at thinking ahead and making decent choices and so on. You know, if we've got an adult who got their butt thrown out of college and keeps losing jobs, it sounds like their skills are not so good. And, you know, the worse the person's skills are, the more of the heavy lifting we'll need to do and the more we'll need to work on helping them develop the skills.
Well, just for this case that we're discussing, how much of a priority would be just helping maybe the mother and possibly even the child to learn about BPT?
Well, that's one of the options. First of all, a question I would have is, you know, how sure are we that an adolescent has borderline personality disorders? I'm real conservative about diagnosing personality disorders in adolescents. A, it can be stigmatizing, and once that's in your record, it can have unfortunate consequences down the road because there are plenty of docs and mental health professionals who are not up to date on this stuff. But also, there's a good deal of evidence that this stuff is a lot less stable in adolescents. And somebody might look really borderline this month, and in 3 or 4 months, they might look totally different. So, you know, sticking a label on them that's going to stay with them for the rest of their life might be a little premature. You know, if the person really does have a consistent, long-term, stable pattern that meets criteria for borderline personality disorder, then by George, they've earned themselves a diagnosis. But I want to make sure we're talking about something stable and long-term here, you know, not just a few months of screwiness. Because think back about your own adolescence, your friend's adolescence, etc. Some kids make it through adolescence being completely reasonable, but there's lots of proof that they find people who've gone through really screwy periods when they were adolescents. I don't know if that answered all of your questions.
No, I mean, it really helps a lot. I mean, and I was kind of thinking, but maybe just better to focus on the unconditional love thing than try to get all complicated with
it. Now, and it sounds like from somewhere this kid picked up the concept that I should, poof, have unconditional love, you know, sort of as, oh, this is my inherent right. Having unconditional love is a good thing, but the idea that it should be this way, and if I don't get it, the thing to do is to be upset about it. There's another thing that's real useful to help people think through. A lot of people's reaction is, if things aren't the way I want them to be, the thing to do is to be upset, and that's supposed to make things improve. And, you know, this comes up with a lot of borderline clients and plenty of non-borderline clients. Generally, by the point where the person's discussing this with me, they've given this a good try. They've put lots of time and energy into being really upset about the stuff they don't like. How well does that work? How happy are they with the results? Obviously, if it worked real well, they wouldn't be in my office talking to me. They'd be cruising along with their life exactly the way they want it to be. It's real handy to help people discover that putting my energy into being upset about the way things are sometimes works, often doesn't work, and often makes things worse. And another option is to accept that whether I like it or not, things are the way they are. How do I want to deal with it? Emotionally, it's often hard for people to get behind that because their gut reaction is, if I don't get upset about it, it won't change. Well, wait a minute. They put their time and energy into being upset about it. Does that make it change? And on the flip side, suppose I accept that things are the way they are. Does that mean it won't change? You know, there are some things that are the way they are, and they're not going to change. I've got lousy eyesight. My eyes are not spontaneously going to improve. If I get upset about having lousy eyesight, that's not going to make my eyesight any better. If I accept that I've got lousy eyesight, does that condemn me to walk around bumping into things? No, I could, except that I've got lousy eyesight, and put on my glasses and see just fine. It doesn't come up a lot with eyesight, but most people have known somebody whose hearing is shot. And they won't accept that their hearing is shot, therefore they don't wear the damn hearing aids, and therefore they can't hear worth of anything. And if they would only accept that their hearing is shot and wear the hearing aids, everybody involved would have got ahead. That often accepting that things are the way they are frees me up to deal with it more effectively. And if we're talking about something that's not going to change, dealing with it as effectively as I can is a good move. And if it's something that could potentially change, accepting that it is the way it is and working on it is a lot more promising than putting my energy into being upset about it. And, you know, I would do that in manageable steps in terms of guided discovery, not in terms of a mini lecture to the client. But that's another thing that can be real useful with lots of borderlines, lots of adolescents, and plenty of other people. Let's switch gears and have a few minutes for your case for consultation.
Yes. I had a young man come to my office. Let me give you a real quick history right quick. This young man come from a family that is very educated, 4 lawyers. Well, there's 10 of them, most of them are either lawyers or doctors. He's the baby. So he comes into my office, 420 was marijuana day. He comes into my office, he was graduating from college, was fasting, praying, because he was doing his dissertation for his senior to graduate from college. In the process of those four, in that dissertation, he was smoking marijuana, not eating. To make a long story short, he ended up having a mental breakdown. Came into my office, parents thought that he was smoking marijuana. I was like, I know marijuana. I worked with a lot of clients. I said, there's more to it than marijuana. So then they found out that he's supposed to be smoking synthetic marijuana. But my thing was, when he came in, very delusional, they took him out of hospital. Let me move back a little bit. He did end up at the school. They dismissed him, but he's not kicked out. He's dismissed at the present time because he had a mental breakdown. He was smoking for 3 days, marijuana. He got arrested because he banged up a cop, stripped down to no clothes, was tasered, never felt the taser, went to jail, started having all type of delusions, talking about stuff was coming out of the toilet, stopped the toilet up, and he said he was, and he thought he was God there for a minute. So all this is going on. So when he came into my office, my question was, and I was going to type it, but it's too much to type. He came into my office, and the family, like I said, very educated doctor, one of his sisters told him that he was suffering with depression. So my thing is, what diagnosis would you give him? Let me add one more small thing. When he started telling his history, he started back when he was a little kid, and he talked about how his daddy almost suffocated him. And he was 5 years old when he remembered that. And from that day on, he felt like he was not a part of his family, but he never said a word about it up until he came into my office. So this went on from 5 years old, now he's 22. So I was curious for what y'all thought.
Okay. And so since we've got limited time, let me just give some thoughts here. First of all, to come up with a diagnosis, we need more information. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the many possibilities, he's at an age where first onset of psychosis is a definite possibility. And so, you know, I would want to get out my copy of this DSM-5 and look through the relevant diagnostic criteria there and see what I know and what I need to know. And one of the things I'd wonder about is, how has his functioning been going up to the point where he, you know, started fasting and praying and smoking pot and so on? You know, if he's cranked along through life, doing just fine, achieving goals, turning his papers on time and so on, and then all of a sudden the shit hits the fan, that wouldn't fit with, particularly with first onset of psychosis. It's not impossible. If he did fine and then gradually over time his functioning was starting to decline, his grades were slumping, he wasn't getting reports in on time, you know, his thinking was getting flakier, etc., that would sound more like, you know, we're moving towards first onset of psychosis. And if so, the sooner we recognize the psychosis and get effective treatment, the better the eventual outcomes are. You get much better outcomes with psychosis if the person gets the problem gets recognized and treated promptly, and that would probably include appropriate antipsychotics. The CBT can also be quite useful with psychosis. You know, so that's one of the possibilities I'd be considering. You know, if somebody smokes a lot of pot and then has a weird reaction, one of the possibilities is street drugs don't have terribly good quality control. He may have been smoking substances he didn't realize he was smoking because his supplier was doctoring it with whatever. With the not feeling the tasers, I would wonder if there was some PCP in the pot he was smoking. Now, if we don't have a sample to run through the lab, we may never know the answer on that one. But that sounds suspiciously like the reaction of people who are on PCP. and they beating up the cop and so running around naked and so on, you know, would fit with that. Now, one of my questions would be, okay, after he is no longer smoking the pot and eating a regular diet and so on, what happens to his functioning? If he reconstitutes and seems fine again, that would seem more like a transitory drug reaction.
Exactly.
Now, if he's still really flaky, a bad drug reaction can have lasting repercussions. And bad drugs and onset of psychosis are not mutually exclusive. You know, bad drugs actually is one of the ways to trigger an onset of psychosis. So that, you know, it could well be both of those.
Plus, did you say he was starving himself?
Yeah.
He was fasting. This first week, I thought the same thing. I was like, okay, first week, you know, you got to get your mind, your head happy,
mm-hmm.
your mind. So second week, I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt.
Mm-hmm.
Third week, he come in, it gets better after the third week. Fourth week, he was admitted back into the hospital.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I would wonder about is, was he substance-free during those 4 weeks?
Exactly.
Or did he get back into doing substances on his own? You know, and, you know, we may have a substance abuse problem of some degree here, you know, as another live possibility. You know, another scenario is when people have a bad drug experience, then you can get into the same sorts of dynamics as you get with panic attacks and depersonalization disorder. Something weird happens. It scares me. I'm afraid I'm going crazy. I'm afraid I'm losing it. I'm afraid I've damaged my brain. So I'm now on the lookout for signs of craziness, signs I damaged my brain, signs that I'm losing it, which then sets me up for false alarms, which panic me more, which have me being vigilant. And this can be self-perpetuating. You know, so that's another of the possibilities. You know, now also, you know, one of the less likely, but one thing that's likely enough so I keep my eyes open for it, is, are there any obsessions and compulsions? Have there been obsessions and compulsions? A lot of people with OCD have, among other things, a fear of going crazy, a fear of losing control. And so if they have a bad drug experience or a bad medical experience or a panic attack or an episode of depersonalization, then they get all wrapped up in obsessing about that, and we're off and running. I've got a client in my caseload currently who, you know, goes through periods of being convinced he damaged his brain by smoking too much pot, which might be more plausible if he wasn't also afraid that he's damaged his brain by bumping it on the barbell when he lifts weights. Okay, this is OCD, this is not a... You know, so we got a lot of possibilities here. When there's a question of psychosis, you know, psych testing can be real useful in sorting that out. Or, you know, a psychiatrist who's experienced with psychosis can be real useful in sorting that out. You know, I don't know if either of those is an option in the setting you're in.
What was the first option? I'm sorry, Mr.
Psych testing.
Oh.
You know, a nice MMPI profile might be real useful.
I'm hoping that's what he gets done while he's in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Because when they called me and told me they took him back to the hospital, I was hoping that
mm-hmm.
would take place.
Yeah. And with the memory of Dad almost smothering him, you know, one possibility is that actually happened. You know, another possibility is something different may have happened, but he as a 5-year-old may have misconstrued what was going on. And it still has the same emotional impact, even if that's not objectively what Dad was doing. You know, another possibility is he's delusional. You know, this could be another manifestation of that. So, you know, and it's real tough to sort out what actually happened when somebody was 5. You know, now, that's not, and also in terms of diagnosis, that's not terribly enlightening. You know, most people who become psychotic have no shortage of trauma in their history. You know, many people who aren't psychotic have no shortage of trauma in their history. So that doesn't really help us sort that out. Now, it certainly, you know, if my experience was of being almost smothered when I was 5, this could have me inclined to react more intensely to weird drug experiences, and could make heavy drug use even more of a bad idea than it normally is. You know, that's certainly one of the possibilities there. Any questions, comments?
Do you say CBT is helpful for psychosis?
Say which?
CBT is helpful mm-hmm. for psychosis.
Yeah. In combination with appropriate meds, in a couple of different ways. One of the big problems with treating psychosis effectively through meds is noncompliance. If people would just take their damn meds as prescribed, they would do much better. Often a chunk of the problem with noncompliance is the client's thinking. For example, I had a client whose thinking was, you know, I don't want to be crazy. Crazy people take meds. I won't take my meds, therefore I won't be crazy. Okay, we need to address that thinking if we want to get him to take his meds, which boils down to using guided discovery and manual steps to help him think through, okay, this is the way it looks to you at the moment. You know, have there been times in the past when you've gone off your meds? Oh, yes, there have. When you've gone off your meds in the past, did you become less crazy or more crazy? I became more crazy. Aha! So one line of thinking is, I don't want to be crazy. Crazy people take meds. I'll go off my meds. But wait a minute, that makes me more crazy. A different way to look at it is, I don't want to be crazy. Crazy people take meds, and meds are often helpful to them. And I know from first-hand experience that when I take my meds consistently as prescribed, I do a hell of a lot better. Which of those makes more sense to you? And so, you know, standard CBT can be real useful in getting overcoming the impediments to noncompliance. It can be helpful for stress management and dealing with problem situations and all that. It can also be useful in dealing with some of the psychotic symptoms. That same guy, you know, years before, one of the times when he went off his meds, you know, he was at the bus stop. It seemed like the guy next to him was, you know, thinking that he was gay. It felt like he had to do something about it. So he shot the guy with a flare pistol and stabbed him with a pocket knife and ended up doing 3 to 5 years in the state prison for felonious assault and then ended up doing a tour of duty in North Coast. You know, and, you know, then when I was seeing him, the voices were telling him this and the voices were telling him that. And so we were able to think, okay, the voices are telling you you should do such and so. Have there been times in the past when you went along with what the voices told you? How did that turn out? How did you feel about being in the state prison and then in North Coast? Aha! So it sounds like your first-hand experience says that when you go along with the voices, this often does not turn out well. You know, suppose, you know, when the voices started telling you stuff, you were able to register, the voices do not have that good a track record. Does this really make sense to me? You know, is there somebody whose judgment I trust that I can run this by? You know, how does that sound as a game plan? And a lot of people with command hallucinations don't get around to stopping thinking, wait a minute, okay, this voice is giving me advice. Might be a good idea to think it over and choose whether to follow this advice rather than automatically going along with what the voices tell me. And that improved his functioning substantially. Unfortunately, it wasn't enough, and he didn't respond well enough to men, so he's actually now back at North Coast. But it was quite helpful. One of the unfortunate things about psychosis is the longer you've had psychosis, particularly if it's been badly managed at first, the worse the outcomes are. You know, if you get appropriate management early on, you get much better long-term results. And with the people who come in to see us, sometimes somebody's coming in promptly with their first episode and we can facilitate them getting effective treatment and we're going to get much better results. And sometimes they're coming in after they've had psychosis on and off for 30 or 40 years, and that may well limit how much we can accomplish. This guy didn't come to see me until he'd had psychosis for probably 30 years. He's older than I am, and I saw him a long time ago. You know, and unfortunately, uncontrolled psychosis is not good for your brain. And it's lunchtime. So have a good month. Barb will be here at 2:00.